I'm Rebecca Chopp, president of Swarthmore College, and I like to welcome you all to this event to celebrate and recognize Constitution and Citizenship Day. In 2004, the federal government mandated that if you receive any kind of federal funding, you have to, on this day, study the Constitution somehow. I don't always like the federal obligations and regulations that they put upon us, but this is actually a really great one because we're able to have wonderful speakers like the one we have today. To introduce Alex Kazar, the Richter Professor of Political Science. Carol, I've just like blanked. Sorry about that. It's Friday afternoon. We'll give the introduction. Thank you. Carol Nakanoff. Sorry about that.
All right.
It's all right, Sandy.
yes, this has been a wonderful opportunity. This unfunded mandate that Congress created has allowed us to bring in recent years, just to name a few, Michael Dukakis, a Swarthmore alum, law professors Sandy Levinson and Jack Balkin, and Judge Jed Rakoff, a Swarthmore alum who was here last year and gave a fascinating talk. So this is not only the Constitution Day lecture this year, but we are combining it with the annual Political Science Gilbert Lecture, which is named in honor of Professor Charles Gilbert, emeritus professor in American politics in political science department. He's still a very active member of our community. He was unfortunately not able to be here today. The event is sponsored by the President's Office, the Department of Political Science, the Center for Social and Policy Studies, and the Black Studies Program. And I'm pleased to introduce Alexander Kazar, the Matthew J. Sterling, Jr. Professor of History and Social Policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Professor Kazar has taught previously at Duke, MIT, and Brandeis, but he has returned to Harvard, where he received both his BA and his PhD. He is a recipient of the Guggenheim Fellowship. He is the recipient of a number of book prizes. The Right to Vote received the Eugene Genovese Prize from the Historical Society and the Albert Beveridge Prize from the American Historical Association. The Right to Vote was also a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize and in history and several other major prizes. A significantly revised and expanded edition was published in 2009 and is used in some of our Swarthmore classrooms. As impressive as this book is, it's even more impressive to me to consider the range of Professor Kazar's intellectual reach. His 1986 book, Out of Work, The First Century of Unemployment in Massachusetts, received several scholarly prizes, including the Frederick Jackson Turner Award from the Organization of American Historians. He has a strong interest in maritime history, and in 2008 co-authored The Way of the Ship, America's Maritime History Revisioned 1600 to 2000. He also co-authored a text integrating the history of science and technology into the mainstream of American history. It is entitled Inventing America, a History of the United States. He co-edits a series on comparative and international working class history. Professor Kazar chaired the Social Science Research Council's National Research Commission on Voting and Elections in 2004-2005. He contributes many pieces to the popular press, NPR, New York Times, Huffington Post, and some of you have already encountered his February 2012 piece in the New York Times, The Strange Career of Voter Suppression. He writes about the history of poverty, election reform, history of democracies, and is now doing quite a lot of work on the history of the Electoral College and efforts to end it. His talk today on voting rights and voter suppression in the United States could not be more timely. In 2008, the Supreme Court upheld Indiana's photo identification law, holding that the state certainly had an interest in preventing voter fraud and in maintaining the integrity of the electoral process, and at the same time that the burden of obtaining the free state photo ID was not undue, not substantial. Subsequent to that, and subsequent to the election of President Obama, with voter registration drives, higher than usual turnout among young people and among African American voters, a number of states have passed voter ID laws that alter rules for voter registration drives, for early voting, for absentee voting. And you probably know that Pennsylvania passed a law much like Indiana's, but that required documentation to obtain the official ID that is among the strictest rules in the nation. So the Supreme Court in Pennsylvania heard that case yesterday. A decision is expected before the end of the month. And Professor Kazar's work locates the recent wave of struggles over the right to vote in a long and rich history in which these struggles are patterned. Professor Kazar, welcome to Swarthmore.
Thank you, Carol, for the very generous introduction, and thanks to the various organizations that sponsored my being here, not all of whom I remembered from your introduction, but thanks to everyone, and thanks to all of you for coming on a beautiful Friday afternoon. I recognize the sacrifice you've made, and we'll try to make this an interesting but not necessarily uplifting hour as we talk about voter suppression. As I'm sure you have all noticed, there is an election campaign underway. Indeed, it's been underway for several years now, or arguably it's always been underway. And since the beginning of this campaign, really since 2009 and starting even with Obama's election in 2008, the issue of voter suppression has been present. It has been there, if not always on center stage. It has been somewhere on the stage. Carol mentioned part of the backdrop to this. You may have seen the article in the New York Times earlier this week, which suggested that perhaps the outcome of the election would be left in doubt because of conflicts over who is permitted to vote, who is not permitted to vote, and legal conflicts over access to the polls. Now, these debates, again, as Carol mentioned, have been set up and have been prompted by the passage of laws in a variety of states, including this one, that could and likely will make it more difficult for some people to vote. The most well-known of these laws are the ID requirements, the new ID requirements, that have been passed, but they, again, these are not alone. There have been laws in several states shortening early voting periods, and there was a particularly notable law in Florida, Florida has now backtracked somewhat from, which was to, in effect, make it very difficult for dangerous third-party radical organizations like the League of Women Voters to protect against their voter registration drives. I mean, the law didn't say they couldn't do it, but it imposed fairly significant financial penalties if they did not turn in any registration forms within 48 hours of when they collected them. So there's, those are some other fronts in which this has been going on. But the centerpiece of the story, although I want to emphasize it, I don't want to go into the details about the other. The centerpiece of the story has been the ID requirements. More than 30 states have tightened their ID requirements in the last 4 or 5 years, and nearly a dozen, depending on how you count and depending on what's going on in the courts, something between 11 and 17, have now passed what are called strict versions of these laws. The strict versions of the laws are ones that require current government-issued photo IDs from a very limited roster of such documents. The actual roster depends, of course, on the state. In Texas, I imagine many of you have heard this, a student ID from the University of Texas does not count, but a concealed gun permit does. I'm not giving this talk in Texas, by the way. I should have said at the beginning that some of us, for people in my line of work, actually this mandate about Constitution Day has been a profits center. People get frequent invitations to speak. There are about a half dozen cases, including yours in Pennsylvania. There are laws that are still embattled in the courts. Some of these laws, and this might come up in discussion, and because it's a fairly arcane point, but it matters whether these laws are passed in states that are covered by the Voting Rights Act or in states that are not. Texas is covered by the Voting Rights Act. And put very simply, in states that are covered by the preclearance provision of the Voting Rights Act, any indication that these laws would have a discriminatory consequence in terms of African Americans and other minorities could jeopardize the law. That isn't necessarily true in other states. So the legal terrain is fairly complicated. And just a very brief aside on that, it's further complicated by the fact that there are a number of people who are worried that when a law like the Texas law, or if a law like the Texas law or the South Carolina law goes to the Supreme Court, that the Supreme Court might possibly use that as an occasion to toss out the preclearance provision of the Voting Rights Act. So there are a lot of things that are going on that are at stake around these laws. These laws have almost invariably been introduced into state legislatures by Republicans. The stated rationale for the laws are that they are necessary to prevent election fraud, which is surely a worthy goal. And it is widely believed that they will have their primary impact on the poor, particularly the young poor and the elderly poor, and the elderly more generally. These are also groups that are considered to be more likely than not to vote Democratic. The laws were the subject of partisan combat in almost every legislature where they were discussed. Actually, Rhode Island may be the one real exception to this. One of the first laws passed in Indiana in 2006, I think, 2007, passed on a straight party vote. Every Republican in the legislature voted for it. Every Democrat voted against it. The New York Times and other newspapers have been editorializing about them repeatedly. You may remember that Bill Clinton actually mentioned this whole issue in his much-celebrated speech at the Democratic National Convention 10 days ago. They have become a big public issue for two reasons. One is that they could tip the election, depending on how many people were prevented from voting or not. And the second reason is that they appear to violate, although this is in the eyes of the beholder, they appear to violate some accepted norms about democratic behavior. The issue is not brand new. I think, again, I want to emphasize this, and I'm going to take you on a fairly long historical excursion, but even at the outset, the issue is not brand new in 2012. For the last 10 years in a fairly insistent form, there has been partisan warfare between Republicans who have been saying that the issue is voter fraud, and the response of Democrats that the issue is not voter fraud, that voter fraud is a minor problem, and that the issue is that anti-fraud laws are being passed in order to prevent people from voting. Those of you with long memories, say way back to 2005, you know, may remember that there was a whole issue about U.S. attorneys in the Bush administration, Republican U.S. attorneys, about six or seven of them, who were removed from office or not renewed in their office because they were viewed as being not sufficiently zealous by Karl Rove about prosecuting election fraud and or by detecting election fraud. So this issue has been around a lot, for the last decade. In Ohio, again, some of you who can remember back to 2004, there was a very interesting, there was a Secretary of State of Ohio, a man named Kenneth Blackwell, who was intent on enforcing the letter of Ohio law so that at his order, thousands of voter registration forms that had been turned in were rejected because the paper was not on the correct weight of paper. He had to backtrack when it was discovered that the forms that his office issued were also not the correct weight of paper. And in 2008, You know, you may recall there was a lot of concern about an organization called ACORN and its voter registration drives. And in the last presidential debate, Senator McCain made a reference, I'm quoting here, he said that ACORN was maybe perpetuating one of the greatest frauds in voter history in this country. To Senator McCain's credit, after he lost, he didn't bring the subject up again about whether ACORN had cost him the vote, although I recently saw a statistic which, if true, I found to be truly alarming. And whether it's true or not, spread it around. It is a statistic that said in a poll conducted in the United States in late November of 2008 found that 52% of Republicans believed that Obama had become president because ACORN had stolen the election. Make of that as you will. I do not want to spend time today engaging in a debate about whether the current wave of laws constitute efforts at voter suppression. I mean, some people argue they're maintaining the integrity of the ballot box. Others call them voter suppression. I have engaged in such debates as recently as last night with someone in another city. But frankly, it's an easy issue, and I want to dispense with it quickly so that we can move on to things more interesting. The answer simply is that these laws are attempts to suppress votes. I mean, the rationale for them, the claims to the contrary, to use is a formal political science term to characterize them, which is they are bogus. The only type of electoral fraud that these laws can prevent, that the ID laws can prevent, is in-person electoral fraud, where I go to the polls and pretend to be you. And that is a crime that barely exists. As authorities acknowledged in Indiana, when it passed the law, there were no known instances of voter impersonation fraud in the state's history. I think that basically there have been similar stipulations in Pennsylvania, as I read from a distance. In Texas, which passed a strict law, between 2008 and 2010, state elections as well, there were a total of 13 million votes cast in Texas. And of those 13 million, there were 5 formal complaints about possible voter impersonation fraud. One Texas legislator quipped, I'm quoting here, there are more UFO and Bigfoot sightings than documented cases of voter impersonation. There have been an interesting recent study, and I'll come back to this at the end of my talk, indicating that these laws have been passed in states where Republicans have a secure majority, where there is a growing non-citizen population, and increasing minority turnout in elections. Vote fraud, and to say this, I want to make a couple of disclaimers here. One, I'm speaking specifically about voter impersonation fraud. There are other kinds of vote fraud which exist to various degrees in the United States. I think most people who are involved with this issue think that the big arena of concern is absentee ballots. That they are much more vulnerable. But they're not addressed by this issue. The other point that I want to make about the IDs in themselves is to say that I don't think that an ID requirement in and of itself need be suppressive. I think you could have a voter ID system that would not constitute voter suppression, would not lead to it. Most countries in the world, or many countries in the world, have some kind of ID requirement. The national Brazilians have a national voter ID card. You know, everybody gets one. Other places have a national identity card, and you just show that. There are ways of having it, but that's not, with the possible exception of Rhode Island's law. That doesn't seem to be what's going on. You could have a law, for example, which said that you have to have a voter ID and stated very clearly that it is the state's responsibility to make sure that everybody in the state has such an ID, and the state will spend the money and invest the resources to do that. And then you could have, as a fallback system, you could have a mechanism which said if somebody shows up at the polls and does not have an ID, they cast a provisional ballot, and while they're doing so, they apply for an ID for future elections. And that way, over time, everybody would acquire IDs. I mean, people have cited, as a version of this that works, the Brazilian system, again, where there are at least there are stories about that Brazilian election officials, going down, taking canoes down the Amazon to find communities of 25 people to make sure that everybody has their voter ID. These people are looking at them like, you're really weird. I want to go fishing. But you can make that kind of effort to make sure, where you make it very clear that it's the responsibility of the state or the national government. That's not, almost all these laws are saying it's up to the individual. You go figure out how to get yourself an ID. It also seems very clear to me that these laws are partisan in their intent and partisan in their potential consequences. We don't know what the consequences are going to be in this election. So what I want to do is not to kind of, I'm happy to discuss this issue, and people may want to challenge this perspective in discussion. But I don't want to spend a lot of time trying to hammer this home. But what I want to do instead is to try to, I hope, maybe broaden our understanding of these laws and to invoke some history, since I am a historian at heart, to try to help us explain why these laws have been passed and what they mean, and why we are engaged in a new challenge, a quasi-challenge to universal suffrage in the 21st century. And what I want to do is to try to offer a framework for looking at this that sees voter suppression as intrinsically linked to advances in voter rights. And I want to offer a suggestion that rights and suppression are dynamically linked to one another, and that laws of this type are not an aberration, but they are, in fact, really as American as apple pie. They fit squarely into our political traditions. And that in the long view, one can see, this may be a little bit too rosy for many of you, it may be a little too rosy for me too, but that one can see the appearance of episodes of suppression as a sign of the advance of some democratic norms, and I'll flesh that out later. And then I want to try to mobilize this history to try to explain why these laws are happening now. Okay, so that's where I'm going, and I'm about to take you on an excursion into the distant past, back to the late 18th century, and then we're going to sprint up to the present with a selected overview of the history of voting rights. The story begins with the Constitution. It has to, because this is Constitution Day. What's most notable about the Constitution with respect to voting rights is that the Constitution says almost nothing about voting rights. Okay, there is no right to vote in the U.S. Constitution, either in the text or the Bill of Rights. Those of you who thought that there was a right to vote in the Bill of Rights, I'm sorry. And the only allusion to the franchise in the Constitution is a statement that everybody can vote for their representatives to the House of Representatives, who can vote for the most numerous house of the state legislature in which they live. Otherwise, the entire issue of voting rights, the franchise, who can vote, who cannot vote, was left to the states. And it was left to the states not because of any high-minded theory or set of principles. It was left to the states because by 1787, every state already had its own particular franchise requirement. In some cases, taxpaying, in some cases, property ownership. Some of the property ownership states, sometimes it was acres, sometimes it was monetary amounts. Okay. The founding fathers were concerned that if they adopted any national standard, that might annoy people in one or two or three states, and that it would jeopardize ratification. So a lot of the key reason this is done has to do with the politics of ratification of the Constitution in the 1780s. And what that did is to create a decentralized framework for voting rights and related issues in the United States that I think in many ways has bedeviled us again and again and again in our history. And that's why, for those of you who are wondering, that's why all these laws that are popping up are state laws. That's why there's very little federal intervention in this. Because from the very beginning, this whole domain, now there have been federal intrusions into this and a federal takeover of some dimensions of it, but the domain was one of the states. Now, if there's no affirmative right to vote in the Constitution in general, the situation, many of you probably know this, but just in case you don't, the situation's even worse with respect to presidential elections. The Constitution says that the electors, people who go to the Electoral College, which is not a phrase that is ever used in the Constitution, actually, Electoral College, and I've recently discovered that it only becomes a current phrase in the 20th century, which is its own interesting aside, but that the electors in each state shall be chosen in such manner as the legislature thereof may direct. Okay? Says what that means in modern terms is that you have a right to vote for president only if the state legislature of your state says that we're going to choose electors by having an election. And it does not have to do so, and it can change its mind about how to do it. In 2000, in Florida, I had the I'm not sure the good fortune is exactly the right word, but the first edition of my book on the history of the right to vote happened to be published about 8 weeks before the 2000 election. So I had a period of popularity as people were looking at arcane features of it. I received a phone call one day from a member, an African-American member of the Florida legislature. This is before the Supreme Court decision that ended the whole thing. And he wanted to know what they could do about the fact that the Republican majority in the Florida legislature was planning, if the Supreme Court case came out wrong, okay? In other words, if it said we Gore can have his recount, and you will recount however many votes, if the court came out wrong, the Florida legislature was going to choose its own electors, okay? And it was basically going to annul the popular vote. And there's reason to believe from the decision in Bush v. Gore that would have been regarded as permissible by the Supreme Court. I mean, there are some questions about the timing about it. But so in presidential elections, I mean, again, part of the framework here is we don't really start out with any federal or national right to vote. I'm going to take advantage of the Constitution Day commemoration to just have one more aside before going back to the mainstream of the story, which is about the Constitution, which is that the drafting in the Constitution of how we choose our presidents, and I'm doing this obviously because we're in a presidential year, really has to be considered, I think, to be among the worst features, just as a matter of constitutional drafting of the U.S. Constitution. I mean, not only did they make an elementary mistake, which most of you, I'm sure, know about, which is that they forgot to indicate some method by which the electors were to distinguish votes for president and vice president, which produced a kind of confusion, and they had to amend the Constitution in 1804 to straighten that out. And not only did they create an institution of that never functioned in the way it was intended, you know, as a body or a set of bodies that would deliberate and choose. But they also did, it seems to me, something that a constitution dealing with political processes should never do. But my own view about this is that if you are drawing up a constitution and you want to talk about the processes through which people gain power, what the Constitution does is to establish the rules. And establishes a set of rules, and then which presumably you think are fair to all parties, and then everybody plays by those rules. What the U.S. Constitution did with this provision that electors shall be chosen in such manner as each state legislature shall decide was to create the possibility of state legislatures changing the rules for partisan advantage and changing them every election if they wanted to. And that is exactly what happened. for the first 20 to 30, 40 years of our history. Again, I presume most of you know this, but some of you may not. The winner-take-all provision, you know, the allocation of electoral votes, which means that you folks, fortunately, are having to get all the television advertising that we are not getting in Massachusetts, because you're the outcome in Pennsylvania is thought to be in doubt. That is not part of the Constitution. That was something that happened as various parties started gaming the system, beginning in the 1790s and then into the early 19th century. In effect, the constitutional design permitted a gaming of the system by the political parties, which was utterly unintended. But I digress. The Constitution left the franchise to the states, and then I think most of you probably know the well-known thread of the story. Most states had property and tax-paying rules. Some had racial restrictions. There were gender specifications everywhere, but in New Jersey, which meant that the franchise at the outset was limited largely to property-owning adult white males. There was some opposition to this, most notably or most vividly from Benjamin Franklin, with what I put on the board, a story that Franklin told, which I've quoted in my book, and just about who owns the franchise, whether it is the man who brings the jackass to the polls, or in fact whether it's the jackass who has the franchise if you have a property requirement. Jackson was the oldest of the founding fathers in Philadelphia, and in many respects probably the most progressive. And just an aside about this quote is that this was a sufficiently well-known story that when I was doing research for this book and I was reading the minutes and records of constitutional conventions from the 1840s, and this date is 1828, but Franklin was long dead in 1828. That's the publication date of a collection. He was saying this in the 1780s. But in the 1840s in constitutional conventions, I found several times in different states people referring to Franklin's jackass. Meaning that, and the way it was said, it was that everybody understood what that meant, in 1845. So the story was extremely well known. In the 60 to 80 years after the ratification of the Constitution, voting rights were then enlarged throughout the country. It's a well known story, an often told story. Property and tax paying requirements were dropped almost everywhere, effectively permitting nearly all adult white males to vote. This is the period of Jacksonian democracy, the rise of democracy. In many states, notably, even non-citizens could vote, something which we can return to in discussion. But citizens who were not citizens but had been here for a couple of years and declared their intent to become citizens. There were limits to inclusion. There were actually more racial exclusions passed in the first half of the 19th century, including here in Pennsylvania, where there was not a racial exclusion at the outset, but one was adopted in the 1830s. Paupers were disfranchised, interestingly. They dropped property requirements, but they disfranchised paupers, and paupers were defined as anybody dependent upon public welfare. But importantly, I mean, this is a real democratic advance. I do not for a minute want to minimize that. But importantly, the democratic expansions of the antebellum period were not intended to extend political rights to the social and class groupings that really in the 19th century and for most of the 20th century defined the limits of democratic thinking. And that's to say, do you extend the franchise to the peasantry and to the industrial working class? And particularly to an industrial working class of semi-skilled and relatively unskilled workers, not artisans, but a real factory working class. Debates over those inclusions marked sort of all of European history and Latin American history, in fact, in the 19th century and well into the 20th century, rather recently. Chile had a literacy requirement for voting, which targeted basically the poor peasantry and some workers until just before the election of Salvador Allende in 1970. But our peasantry, or the closest thing we had to a peasantry, was enslaved in 1820 or 1830. When these laws were being, when the suffrage was being expanded. So nobody worried that dropping property requirements or other requirements in 1820, 30, or 40 was going to end up enfranchising these millions of agricultural laborers in the South because they were slaves anyway. And in the North, very notably, almost all of the expansionary laws that were passed were passed before the Industrial Revolution had proceeded very far. They were mostly passed in the North by the 1820s. There's a fascinating debate in New York, which passes its key laws in 1820 or 1821, where there's some opposition to getting rid of the property requirement, and people are talking about, you know, what if we turn out, you know, looking like England and looking like, you know, like the an industrial center, like places in England where cotton mills are growing. And the response to that, the counter argument from the people who wanted to enfranchise, who wanted to expand the franchise and end the property requirement, the counter argument was not, well, those textile workers should be enfranchised anyway. They're people, you know, they're workers. That was not the argument that was made. The argument was made was we have nothing to worry about. And in a notable phrase from one man, he said, I would not support this were I not completely confident that New York will remain a predominantly agricultural state for the next 1,000 years. That was in 1820. He was off by 970 years in that prediction of what would happen. The point of this, the reason I bring up, which is a little bit sort of arcane in certain respects of comparative history, is to say that I'm not sure, or in a lot of ways, I suspect that there was never really a commitment in the United States in the 19th century and not pretty far into the 20th century towards universal suffrage. That when the voting rights were expanded, people were picturing a different society, a society that was more equal, more homogeneous, and with a much higher proportion of people who owned land, okay, or owned some kind of property, and so that I'm not sure there was ever the expansions did not necessarily reflect a commitment to universal suffrage. The high water mark in the expansion of voting rights in the 19th century was the 15th Amendment. The 14th Amendment, a little bit. The 15th Amendment, I'm sure most of you know, but the 15th Amendment, which banned denying people the right to vote because of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. This comes right after the Civil War, not surprisingly. And it really is, and in some ways it's quite extraordinary that the freedmen are enfranchised and African Americans throughout the country, because African Americans couldn't vote in most places in the North either, and that this does happen. Given prevailing attitudes, it was quite an extraordinary thing. Now, this 60 to 70 year expansion of voting rights ends up setting the stage for a series of reversals in the last 30 years of the 19th century, and in so doing, giving rise to the first wave of voter suppression. I am coming back to the voter suppression issue. It gives rise to the first wave of voter suppression. I'll show you a little engram that my assistant worked up about the use of the phrases voter suppression and vote suppression. But the phrase vote suppression first becomes current in the United States in the 1870s and 1880s and 1890s. It's actually vote suppression then, not voter suppression. And what's happening in the late 19th century, of course, two different things. There is a crackdown. There's voter suppression starting to happen, and there is a loss of faith in democratic institutions and a loss of faith in universal suffrage in both the South and the North, and people who we would today call opinion makers. And let me give, this is a view of a very, very eminent American intellectual, I'm sad to say a historian, Francis Parkman, writing in 1878. And what Parkman is saying, and here in Parkman's talking about the North, not the South. What Parkman is saying is that now that we've got all these horrible foreigners coming in, all these horrible immigrants coming in who are untrustworthy and would probably steal elections and commit electoral fraud of various sorts, that that universal suffrage is not a desirable thing anymore. I mean, this is from a leading American intellectual. Another version of that by an anonymous writer just the year before, and I won't bother reading through it, but it's another statement of the same view. So what you have in the South, of course, the political rights of African Americans are imposed upon white Southerners. I mean, there's a few exceptions, but they're imposed by Union armies and by the government in Washington. If you want to be readmitted to the Union, you better you have to go along with this. And I'm not sure that many white Southerners had a lot of faith in the democratic potential of African Americans at the time. And in the North, there's this backing away again. And this, the case that I want to, this really does lead to these first major episodes of voter suppression. And here I want to make a conceptual distinction, which I think is useful, which is to distinguish between vote suppression and disfranchisement, terms that in the current debates I think have tended to be used too interchangeably by participants on all sides. Disfranchisement or disenfranchisement is taking away a person's legal right to vote, taking away the legal, just simply taking it away, or taking away a group's legal right to vote, changing your legal rights. If you pass a law saying that black people can't vote, you are disfranchising them. If you pass a law saying that people under the age of 25 can't vote, you are disfranchising. Or you could say that short people can't vote. That would be a law that disfranchises. Suppression, it seems to me, is something different, and we should understand it as something somewhat different. It's what you do if you want to disfranchise people, if you want to keep them from voting, but you are unable to, politically or ideologically, that you can't, in fact, disfranchise them. So what suppression means is making it hard for them to register and vote, put obstacles in their path, maybe surmountable obstacles, but surmountable obstacles that would take a lot of work and energy and resources. And what suppression does is not to blanket prevent an entire group of people or an entire category of people from voting, but it shrinks their participation. It winnows down the size of the group. Disfranchisement and suppression proceed from the same impulse, but I think that they signal the existence of different political and ideological climates. In the South in the late 19th century, thus, efforts to reduce the political participation of blacks first took the form of suppression. Okay, that was the first forms were suppression. Violence was one of those forms of suppression. Vigilante violence was one way to do that. And other legal devices like requiring people to present the receipts that they had paid their poll taxes, having complicated ballot arrangements. A lot of the first whole waves of laws in the South did not wholesale prevent black people from voting, but just began to cut down on it. That they had to do this, white Southerners had to do this, because of the 15th Amendment. And because they couldn't change the 15th Amendment. The 15th Amendment said that you cannot disfranchise someone based on race, color, or previous condition of servitude, and the South was not going to be able to get the North to agree to reverse the 15th Amendment. But there's a turning point that comes, In this history, and it comes really in the 1890s, probably in the early 1890s, partly with the failure of the Lodge Force Bill. You don't have to know what Lodge Force Bill was actually an early version of the Voting Rights Act, and it came very close to passing Congress in about 1890, and it didn't. But there were clear signals that began coming out of Congress at that point, that the North was not going to police what was going to go on in the South. And at that point, what happens is that the white South decides that it can move from suppression to outright disfranchisement and pass more draconian laws, the ultimate step of which was, of course, the white primary, where they basically, and by this point there was no Republican Party in the South. The only elections that mattered were in the Democratic Party, and Southern states began to pass laws saying that only white people could vote in Democratic primaries. That's the Southern story. In the North, you got a wave of suppressive laws and suppressive tactics that seemed to me to be remarkably similar to some things that we're seeing today, okay? And these are aimed at immigrant workers, by and large. You see literacy tests also. A literacy test is not quite a disfranchising. It's somewhere on the border of disfranchising and suppression, because if you are illiterate, you can become literate if the test is fairly administered. There were poll taxes also in the North, and there were very intricate registration requirements adopted in a number of places, often applicable only to large cities or only to targeted cities. Pennsylvania at several points had registration laws that applied only to Philadelphia or only to Pittsburgh. In New York State, there was a requirement that you had to register to vote every year, but only if you lived in a city with a population more than 500,000. Right? It was the whole category. But there was only one city in New York State that you don't want to just name the city. That would look like you were targeting a city. So every city over 500,000, you had to register every year. In many places, you had to register if you moved and changed precincts within the city. You had, in some states, passed laws saying that you had to present your naturalization papers at the polls. That in some places you were supposed to, before you registered, bring witnesses to establish your residence. In one very ingenious move at voter suppression, targeted at left-leaning Jews in New York City during the Progressive Era, a registration law was passed. I think it's 1908, but it's a year around there. Which said that you had to register every year, and then the only days in this particular year when you could register were either on Saturdays, the Jewish Sabbath, or on Yom Kippur. not very well disguised effort to prevent certain groups from voting. Yet another technique had to do with the hours that you kept the polls open, right? People worked a 10-hour day. If you were an industrial worker, if you closed the polls at sunset, which they began doing, you know, or earlier, you would keep a lot of people from voting. And again, you know, what I would say about these laws is these were suppressive techniques because outright disfranchisement was not politically possible, because there were political parties that were relying on some of the votes of these new immigrants. It partly was ideologically difficult, but also they had acquired enough political power so that they couldn't be banned outright. That's why in New York, for example, there's a very interesting struggle over this when, in a complicated backdoor fashion, New York tries to reimpose a property requirement for voting by creating a new board that will control the finances of New York City. And to say that to vote for this new board, you have to own a certain amount of property. And they're able to block that and defeat it eventually. So that, again, it becomes impossible to have outright disfranchisement laws, and the next best thing is voter suppression from that perspective. And then just let me briefly show you. This is the This is the vote suppression. This is the number of appearances or something in print of the phrase vote suppression over time. And as you can see, it goes forth from 1880 to 1960. I do not understand. Maybe someone here does. I do not quite understand why there is this peak, this 120th century peak. But I will be exploring that at some point in the future. And then here is the more modern term, voter suppression, which you can see that also pops up a little bit at these same points earlier. And then, as you can see, as we get towards the 21st century, you have this enormous increase in the incidence of the phrase. What I want to suggest here is that this late 19th century wave of suppression, that it was a reaction by large numbers of Americans to a very substantial and potentially decisive shift in the composition of the American electorate under existing laws, okay? And that the reaction to this constituted these waves, and that these new groups were African Americans in the South and immigrant workers in the North and in parts of the West. We should understand voter suppression in this context as a response to an earlier expansion of the franchise, and then this kind of social enlargement of that by both the Civil War, but also by social forces such as immigration, which produced really quite unforeseen consequences in terms of the people who had passed the laws. Now I want to fast forward here. In the history, and I'm going to skip over those minor years between 1900 and the 1950s. There's something of a stasis in the history of voting rights, except, of course, with the enormous exception of the enfranchisement of women, which is an extremely important story, but doesn't intersect very directly with this story. But basically, this if the late 19th century is a period of reaction against a broader franchise which had already occurred. Things are fairly stable for about 50 years, and then there are extraordinary advances that take place after World War II. There is a nationalization of voter rights after World War II and of voting rights, and really something of a minor political revolution, and I don't use that word cavalierly. The second Reconstruction, as it was called, was real and dramatic. It happened through constitutional amendments, through legislation like the Voting Rights Act, and through court decisions. The upshot of it was that African Americans were enfranchised in the South a century after the 15th Amendment had been passed, but better late than never, one presumes. Native Americans in a number of Western states who had not been permitted to vote were enfranchised. Devices such as literacy tests and poll taxes were banned from use throughout the United States. The literacy tests, even as late as the 1960s, is not a purely Southern phenomenon. There was a literacy test in New York, and it was an English language literacy test. And the people that it was having its greatest impact on were actually Puerto Rican-born U.S. citizens living in New York, of whom the figures roughly 500,000 could not vote. That's what arcane detail. But if you look at the Voting Rights Act, there are two counties of New York that are actually covered by the Voting Rights. If the Voting Rights Act covers New York and Alabama, and that's really the reason why. All of that is eliminated. The age of voting is reduced. And then the protections given to African Americans through the Voting Rights Act in the 1960s are extended to what are called language minorities in the 1970s. It's a way, basically, it's the other minority groups. Language minorities is something of a euphemism for doing this. One could thus speak, there's a show, key point, enormous expansion of the franchise, and one could meaningfully speak of universal suffrage in the United States existing by the early 1970s. Not before. I mean, whatever we say about we're the world's oldest, greatest democracy and everything, we universal suffrage, okay, 1970, although some people would argue about even that, given the felon disfranchisement laws and other things, but universal suffrage by 1970. Now, a note here about this change in the electorate. Without the change in the composition of the U.S. electorate that happened in the 1960s, Barack Obama could never have been elected president. Put aside changing attitudes, which we know are important as well, changing attitudes, changing norms, changing values. Picture an election in which African Americans did not vote in the South. As you know, Obama won Virginia and North Carolina last time, and he did not win a majority of the white vote. And, you know, so that's so one key ingredient. Hispanic voters, which voted something like 61% Democratic, and young voters, you folks, if you voted in 2008, you know, if you're voting now, if the voting age was 21 instead of 18, and that group also broke very heavily for Obama. The electorate of 1965 would not have chosen Barack Obama or anybody like Barack Obama to be president. And it's in this context that I want to come back and then relocate the current wave of voter suppression efforts, okay? Because what I want to say is that, or what I want to suggest, is that they are a response to the significant enlargement of the American electorate over the last two generations. They are a response to the enfranchisement of African Americans in the South and their growing political power since the 1960s, and they are a response to an extremely large wave of immigration that has affected many parts of the United States, particularly but not exclusively since 1980. Now, to be sure, you don't automatically have to have a counter-reaction to such an expansion. It's not political tendencies are not laws of physics, so that you would have to have this. But I think it would also be naive to expect that the people who resisted the expansions of the franchise of the 1960s and the 1970s would suddenly all change their minds about their beliefs in universal suffrage and whether or not that was a significant value. And those are the people who still, when you get them into conversation, often in public, still talk about voting as a privilege and not as a right. Indeed, there's always been at least latent, resistance to broad voting rights in the United States. The dirty little secret of American democracy is that not everybody believes in it. And if we have these broad changes that created the preconditions for suppression, then I think there are two other things which provided triggers to the new wave. Again, I'm trying to try to explain why this has happened. The first was that there were a series of efforts, which are not that much talked about now, but a series of legal efforts in the 1990s to make it easier for poor people to register and vote, okay? The most well-known of these was the National Voter Registration Act, commonly known as the Motor Voter Bill. The Motor Voter Bill was actually first passed by Congress in, I think it was 1992, when President Bush, the father, was still president, and he vetoed it on the grounds that the Motor Voter Bill was going to encourage fraud. A year later, George Bush was back in Maine, and Bill Clinton signed the same bill, and it became law, and it really did provide tremendous encouragement. The Motor Voter Bill said that you had to provide registration materials to vote at government offices, particularly motor vehicle bureaus. And then it was expanded in its reach in a number of ways, including welfare offices, so that it became more really encouraging and particularly encouraging certain targeted populations to register. There had been some earlier efforts in the same direction. Jimmy Carter, in the 1970s, in response to growing concerns, which were bipartisan concerns, actually, in the 60s and into the 70s, concerns about falling turnout in American elections, Jimmy Carter proposed something called the National Uniform Registration Act in 1977, which would have created a national system of registration, eliminating a lot of the complexities we've come to hear so much about. And to his surprise, it produced fierce opposition, not only from Republicans, but from a lot of conservative Democrats as well. Jimmy Carter seemed to get surprised a lot, actually. was very well-meaning. He was also very surprised when his proposal to get rid of the Electoral College didn't pass. His proposal would have, among other things, permitted Election Day registration. This is 1977. But there's no real progress that's made on these things until the 1990s and somewhat thereafter, when you get the Motor Voter Bill, and in some places you get same-day registration, early voting, all these mechanisms to encourage voting. The current wave of suppressive efforts, I think, have to be understood as pushback against those laws primarily from the 1990s and the early 2000s. So that's sort of one of the precipitants, finally. A second precipitant is that we have had a pattern of close national elections, which was also true in the late 19th century, by the way, of close national elections with somewhat shifting majorities, narrow margins in important states in the Electoral College. The lesson that political professionals took from the 2000 election, and we all knew, I mean, everyone was walking around, from Bill Clinton, on down saying, see, every vote does count, looking at what happened in Florida. And it was true, and it's, and people who run political campaigns and politicians, control of the national government depended in 2000 on way less than 0.1% of the vote of one state. So what that meant was a couple of different things to political professionals. One is that it's really important to get the vote out for your candidate. But it will also do very well if your opponent's votes don't all get counted or your opponent's supporters don't all show up to vote. In fact, one is just as good as the other in terms of the net result. But I think it's this closeness, this part of the closeness of partisan rivalry that is the other major precipitant. And then if you want to look at really the very specific timing of why so many of these laws in the last 24 months, it has to do with the congressional elections and the state legislative elections of 2010, when the Republicans came to control a bunch more state legislatures, and then they passed these through. So what are the conclusions that we can draw from this story? One is that I don't think we should be surprised by these recent suppressive efforts. I don't think we should I think we can still be indignant, but I don't think we should be surprised. They fit into broad patterns of U.S. history, that movements forward in promoting democratic rights and processes have tended to be followed by reactions against that. And that those reactions have tended, when we look at the American past, to be particularly strong when the new voters, the new sources of political power, the new wielders of political power are ethnically and or religiously different from, quote, mainstream American society and when they come from the working classes or the poor. It is not a coincidence that the targets of suppression and disfranchisement in the United States have been similar over the last century and a half. It's the same kinds of folks that are always tolerated. Were to take the obverse of this, to my knowledge, and I've been studying this for quite a long time, nobody has ever tried to disfranchise or suppress upper middle class or elite white males. It hasn't happened. Now, to say it fits into our patterns and that this is all, I mean, that doesn't mean that we should embrace it, and it doesn't mean that we should relax our vigilance, or it doesn't believe, depending on what your own values are, that you shouldn't be trying to resist and change those laws. But what I really am trying to suggest is to think about where they are coming from, and that they are coming from sort of some larger forces and some larger lines of cleavage in the United States. And my final comment here, and I'm committing very bad form in terms of talk giving, I'm violating the talk giver's manual by introducing a new topic in my last three sentences. And obviously I'm trying to set this up a little bit for discussion. But the existence of these broad patterns of these ebbs and flows of advances followed by reactions against it and various changes in the ideological climate strongly suggests to me the need to amend our Constitution to include an affirmative national right to vote, which in fact might very well serve to make suppressive efforts more difficult and weaker in the future. Thank you. You know, Delmore Schwartz's old comment that even paranoids have enemies. I'm not sure whether I see a correlation there. I think that some of the same social conflict and social forces are going on in both phenomena. I mean, the extraordinary size of our prison population, you know, in the United States, and its extraordinary growth since 1980 is, and the fact that it's predominantly a minority population or a group, a different minority, is very striking, very stunning. You know, I don't want to quite imagine that there's some like little group of people from the American Legislative Exchange Council or whatever, that, you know, Alec, the Republican, that's sitting sort of thinking about the links between all these things in some conspiracy. I don't quite think that that's going on. People are aware. Let me just state it this way. Politicians are aware of the potential political impact, particularly in some states, of ex-felons voting. Right, I mean, in Florida, in 2000, I mean, we know this. There are approximately 650,000 ex-felons who could not vote. Okay, now, you know, it has to be said, ex-felons do not have the highest turnout rates in American society. But you know, if they voted the way you would expect them to vote, which would have been Democratic, and 1,000 of the 660,000 had shown up, which is a pretty low turnout rate, that would have been the election. And then if you look at what's happened in Florida since then, you know, where Charlie Crist, the last liberal Republican on earth, tried by executive order to liberalize the reenfranchisement policies in Florida. And then as soon as Scott came back into power, he reversed it. So they are aware in some states in particular about that this is a potential political force. But I think the real links are in this larger question of kind of social conflict and the role of minorities in our society. I'm not sure I understand all the pieces of the question. Let me address what I grasp and then come back to me, which is I don't know what's exactly the case that more Republicans voted for the Voting Rights Act. Probably fewer Republicans voted against it. Yeah, okay, you know, that might well. But, I mean, the key thing there is that the Democrats who opposed the Voting Rights Act are now Republicans. I mean, the critical political realignment that occurs in the wake of the 60s and in the wake of the Voting Rights Act was to drive those white Southerners who were resistant to these changes out of the Democratic Party and into the Republican Party. So that has played a big role in this question. Now, it also has meant that to do a cartoonish, version of this history, if there's something going on, long going on in the United States of sort of suppressing certain kinds of, you know, working class and poor groups, it was a much more bipartisan story before 1965, because basically the Democrats did it in the South and the Republicans did it in the North. But with that realignment in the 1960s, so the Republicans have become custodians of those impulses north and south. It was an important historic change. There's a new book out, just published 2 weeks ago, by Tova Wang on this question, and she traces some of this flip. And you might find it to be interesting. Did I answer enough of your question? No, but the double standard, I mean, in terms of Democrats, I mean, most of the what I'm talking about in the late 19th century South is being done by Democrats. Right? That's, I mean, well, most of those actual people are have moved on to their reward. I mean, I think it was determined sometime recently that even Strom Thurmond was mortal. But you know, when you had somebody, and you're probably too young to remember this incident, it wasn't a big enough incident to have lived. But for those of us, I mean, this was maybe 10 years ago, when Trent Lott, senator from Mississippi, okay, and I think at that point the minority leader of the Senate, at an event for Strom Thurmond said, you know, if more of us had recognized how right you were back in 1948, right? He would seem to me was, and Strom Thurmond ran in 1948, breaking from the Democratic Party because it was too liberal on race, right? I mean, that was, he didn't want any civil rights. It seemed to me that what Trent Lott was doing there was publicly proclaiming the allegiance of his generation of Republican leaders to the ideology of people like Thurmond, because he said it in public. I mean, yes, you're right. Now, I mean, how much has changed? Look, I would be delighted to think that a lot of that had changed, and maybe more has changed than I think. You know, I lived in North Carolina when a man named Harvey Gantt, the black mayor of Charlotte, ran for the Senate against, what was his name? Against Jesse Helms, right? And I watched that campaign firsthand, and it was, you know, it was pretty disturbing. It was 20 years ago, but no, look, we should move on. I should move on to other people. Why don't we chat afterwards? I think that the predominant interactive dynamic has gone the other way. Okay, I think in fact that the expansions have tended to come in what look more like periods of kind of calm and stasis and stability, and then something may happen which triggers the reaction, rather than real expansions coming in reaction. Against those reactions. I think that what happened in the North, for example, in the early 20th century, I mean, the South was its own story, right? The South had disfranchised black people, and that's the way it stood, pretty much. Some variation in some states 30, 40 years later, but that's pretty much the way it stood. In the North, most of the deals are cut by about 1910 or 1915, and they're compromises. You know, they're compromises. There are suppressive laws. They keep some folks out. But they're not so suppressive in most places that a well-organized political machine can't figure out some way to live with it. Okay? I'll give you an example. So you have to present your naturalization. Your naturalization papers have to be presented to register. Okay? Well, but if you tweak the law, and that can only happen between, say, 9 and 5, Monday to Friday, when you're working, okay? But if you tweak the law so that the voter himself does not have to show up with the naturalization paper, but somebody who works for the political organization can go in with 100 of them and get 100 voters certified, okay, then the machine can live with it. And so you get deals that are cut, but they're local deals in most cases. I think that my answer to that is that I think the U.S. has encountered the same kind of resistances, the same kind of conflicts over enfranchisement as other countries. Okay, both in Europe and in Latin America. That in the U.S. the dynamics of it were somewhat peculiar. Precisely because we had this early formal expansion of the franchise. Right? What happens between 1790 and 1850, 1860, is actually quite unusual. I mean, the British model is much more of a series of incremental advances, and what they mean is agreed upon, okay, and acknowledged. You know, they knew when they were at different steps, they knew precisely who was being enfranchised by these laws, okay? What happens in the United States is you get these laws are passed, and then the social composition of the population changes. And so a whole bunch of people have become enfranchised that you never intended. So then you get a counter-reaction against it. And it's a different, it's simply a different chronology and thus a different set of dynamics, although the underlying issues are the same. I've been ignoring people here. Right. Let me do a couple steps back because I'm presuming probably not everybody in the room really knows what the preclearance requirements are. Am I right? Yeah. The preclearance requirements are a part of the Voting Rights Act of 1965, and this applies actually only to what are called covered jurisdictions. It's New York and the South, not just those, but which had jurisdictions which there was some reason to believe were engaged in discrimination. What the preclearance requirement does is to say that if a covered jurisdiction makes any change to its electoral laws, changing the way districts are done, changing its procedures, one way or another, that change has to be pre-cleared by either a federal court or the Justice Department. Okay, the reason for that was the quite sound suspicion that once the Voting Rights Act, that disfranchising people is not the only way of limiting their power. You know, for example, you could go from a system where you had district elections in a city, and you have 10 members of a district, and then suddenly you had to enfranchise African Americans who were 35% of the city, and suddenly you change and you don't elect your city council by district, but you do it by at-large elections. So that all whites will win by a two-thirds majority. You can't make those changes, and do that. So the preclearance requirement has been for much of the time has been an important safeguard against that. If the preclearance requirement were abandoned, or if it were struck down. It would mean that I think the clearest consequence is that it would mean that actions could be taken to change electoral laws that might have quite discriminatory consequences, but that you could not really fight them until after they had been in operation and done some harm. I think there's a lot of fear out there, okay? I don't think this is, just like nasty people sitting there and saying, let's limit, the meaning of citizenship. I think there's a lot of fear and apprehension. And it's obviously made worse by the time that we're living in a lousy economy right now. I think there are some concerns about actually limiting the parameters of citizenship. For example, the movement, which flared for a while, it seems to have receded, about getting rid of birthright citizenship, right? I mean, that was sort of a hot talking topic for a while. I guess I see that there's a lot of apprehension. And then let me add a historical footnote. One of the strange things in the U.S. is that citizenship has always been separated from voting rights. Citizenship does not bring you voting rights. There's a very important Supreme Court case on that in the 19th century, which actually dealt with women. One of the strategies that that activist women used when they were trying to get enfranchised, they went to the courts and they said, and it was ingenious, and it was after the Civil War, and they said, we should be able to vote because we're citizens. And that really gave the court some trouble because they said we don't have to have an amendment, we don't have any change, we are citizens. You say we're citizens, we should be able to vote. And the Supreme Court mulled this around for a while, and said, well, you are citizens, but actually, sorry, but citizenship does not bring the right to vote. That citizenship is actually a federal matter, and voting rights are a state matter. I think
we should stop the formal portion of this. Professor Kazar will still be here for a few minutes, but I think we should thank him for